Good morning, everybody. It's great to be with you. My name's Chris. If we've not met before, it's great to be able to add my welcome to the other Chris's welcome this morning. And I'm really looking forward over these next few minutes that we've got together to unpack a little bit more in this Alive series that we've been talking about that we've just seen introed there. And by the way, if you want to see those full videos, just get in touch with us because we can point you to them and you can watch the whole of the story. I've been watching this week on iPlayer, on BBC iPlayer, a documentary series that I think has been around for a while that you may have seen. I only came across it this week, called The Rescue. And it's the story of, do you remember a few years ago in the news, a huge story about the 13 boys, 12 members of a football team and their coach that got trapped in a cave, deep in a cave, in northern Thailand due to monsoon rains and that kind of stuff. And the rescue that then went on over a two-week period to get them out and to rescue them. I don't know whether you remember that, but this documentary is about the rescue that was done and how it happened. And although I'd seen the news story and all that kind of stuff, I'd not twigged at all, really, what went in to rescuing them. Hundreds and hundreds of people and the most extraordinary and incredibly complicated rescue. But what really struck me about the documentary, because really the story revolves around two British cave divers. So the very best cave divers in the world, actually. And it's their story, really, of how they were called upon to go and how they were a huge part of that rescue operation. But what really interested me about them is, and they say this about themselves, so I think it's okay to say this, they're slightly odd characters. A little bit oddballs, really. So they were growing up quite isolated. They were loners, bullied at school a bit, weren't into sort of team sports and all that kind of stuff, weren't really very sporty people, until they found this sport of caving, but not just caving, actually like going underwater in caves, which just for most of us, myself included, would be the most horrific idea, right? In confined spaces, underwater with air that could run out. It just sounds like an awful proposition to me. But they had found their kind of niche with it, and they were brilliant at it, and the very best in the world, and they were called upon to go. And they started diving in these caves, but they didn't know at that point, but the boys were a kilometer and a half into the caves, underwater, and you had to go basically a kilometer and a half underwater through like tight holes and all that kind of stuff to get to where they were. So these two cave divers were exploring the caves along with some others, Thai Navy SEALs and that kind of stuff, but they really didn't have either the equipment or the skills that these two British divers did. And their journey through a whole range of emotions, particularly in the area of hope, is really what interested me as I was watching that, because they arrived quite hopeful. But as they started diving, and as they particularly they were having to swim in these caves against a current of water that was very strong, in very murky and horrible conditions, and in tight and confined spaces, their hope began to ebb away, really. And then by day 8 of the rescue, when they dived a number of times exploring through these caves and not found anything, really their hope had gone. And there's a moment where on day 8 they gave up. And they said, we just don't think there's any way we can do this. We don't think the boys are even alive. And even if they are, there's no way we can get any further than we've gone in these caves. So they had absolutely no hope. They were completely in despair. And actually later on, you see them saying they really regretted that. But basically they gave up, and I can't remember what it was, but something made them try again. And they went back in, and eventually they made it all the way through, and they found, these two British cave divers, found the boys and their coach. And suddenly hope was built again. But even from that point, even having found them, they still went through this incredible peak and trough of hope, because now, having found them, there was huge hope, and they could take camera footage of them that they brought out and showed to everybody. So everybody was really hopeful. But then the prospect of trying to get them out through that kilometer and a half of submerged conditions, then suddenly hope drained away again. but eventually, and I won't, you'll have to go and watch it, they found a way and they got them out, which is was the most extraordinary thing. But it was that range of emotions of hope that I found really interesting. We're asking the question in this series, what do you need to feel fully alive? What do you need to feel fully alive? And last week, we talked about love. We talked about the first thing we need to feel fully alive is to be transformed by love. And this week, we're talking about hope. The second thing we need to feel fully alive is hope. And I found a couple of quotes about hope this week that I wanted to share with you. The first comes from the 19th century Russian author Dostoevsky, who said, "To live without hope is to cease to live. We need hope to be fully alive." And then Desmond Tutu said this, "Hope is being able to see that there is light despite all of the darkness." They are recognizing what I think most of us would recognize, which is that hope is essential for us to be and to feel fully alive. But like love, and when I talked about love last week, I said it has to be the right kind of love to make us feel alive. Because a love with strings attached, a conditional love, can actually lead us to feel more like we're dying than we're living. It can bring a weight and a burden to us. And it's the same with hope. If it's not the right kind of hope, it won't lead us to feel fully alive. Here are some different kinds of hope that I was thinking about this week. There's vague hope. You know, like we have vague hope. I hope the sun comes out today. I hope that my football team win. I hope, and I heard Chris Jules, because I was in the studio listening to it, say, I hope the talk is going to be short today. Well, good luck with that. So they are, sorry, I'm joking. They are vague hopes, right? And then there is a kind of an optimistic hope. You know, that kind of hope that's characterized by a very positive view of the future. And there's nothing wrong with that particularly. I mean, on one level, I think I would count myself as quite an optimistic person. But the danger of optimistic hope is that it can cloud our judgment about things that are really going on. It can stop us seeing the reality of things. And actually, we don't deal with facts, and we just end up with wishful thinking with no particular action. What then about a slightly different kind of hope? What about realistic or resilient hope then? Hope that doesn't give up on a kind of a positive expectation, but also realizes there are some facts of reality that we need to take into consideration. A realistic hope is about a belief that the future can be better than the present, and a belief that we can take some action to make it so. Now that sounds a lot better than vague hope or optimistic hope and wishful thinking. And actually this kind of hope has been proven to increase work productivity, to increase well-being, and to increase physical health. But even this kind of hope has some limitations, because there are some situations that are simply impossible to overcome by our own act of will or action, because they're outside of our control, things that we can't predict or control or really have any influence over. So even realistic hope has its limitations. So then the right question to ask is, well, then what kind of hope do we need? What hope do we need to feel fully alive, and where do we get it? Well, today we're going to look at the second of the five resurrection appearances of Jesus, the five times where Jesus appeared after he had risen from the dead to a whole bunch of his friends and followers. And we're looking at the second one of those today. And we're going to see how despair turned to hope. And to do that, we're going to look at Luke's account of the life of Jesus, which is in the New Testament part of the Bible. Luke was a doctor and has been proven to be an amazing historian. His two books in the New Testament, the book of Luke and the book of Acts, are full of historical evidence and facts that have been checked and found to be true. So they're a reliable source of historical information about both Jesus and about the early churches. So we're going to look at chapter 24 of Luke's account of the life of Jesus. And we're going to start in verse 13. And as we do this, we're going to find, I think, and I hope, and I have an optimistic hope about this, we're going to find what we need to build this different kind of hope that we need to feel fully alive. So the same day, so it says now that same day. Now this is still Easter Sunday. It's still the first Easter Sunday. So that's the time that we're dealing with when we hear about now that same day. So the first Easter Sunday 2,000 years ago. Now that same day, two of them, these are Jesus's friends and followers, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. So they have been in Jerusalem, as Jesus's friends and followers have been. They have lived through Jesus's crucifixion. And now, after all of that, they are on their way, probably going back home. So now they are in this situation where all their hope has been crushed. They're not hanging around in Jerusalem. They're not expecting anything to happen in Jerusalem. Their friend and their teacher, Jesus, they've seen him die on a cross and laid in a tomb. And they are not expecting anything else. They are probably also afraid. They're worried that they might be next. So they are on their way, probably on their way home. They are skeptics. They are not expecting a resurrection. They're not expecting Jesus to come back from life, and they are afraid. And interesting, which you'll discover in a few verses' time, the name of one of these. We don't know the name of the second one, but we know that one of these is somebody called Cleopas, who was not part of the inner group, the very closest of Jesus' 12 disciples or friends, slightly outside of that group. This, I think, is more evidence that we can believe in the truth of this story. Because if you were making this up, if you were Luke and you were writing this after the fact and you were making up a resurrection, you would not use Cleopas and his friend as the two people to pick who had seen Jesus come back to life. That's not what you do, because they weren't the famous ones. They weren't John or Peter or any of those, James or any of those. They're obscure people. And again, if you were trying to make this story up and convince people of its truth, you wouldn't pick these people. And we said this last week, 2,000 years ago, in the culture of the day, women were second-class citizens, and you would not have picked a woman to have been the first person to see Jesus resurrected from the dead, and yet Mary was the first person. So this continues this pattern of, I think, evidence for the fact that this is not a made-up story, because these are not the people that you would go to if you were going to make up the story. Right, we're going to read on. So they were having a chat about everything that happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. Now, we don't quite know what was keeping them from recognizing him, but it may well have been their skepticism. They were not expecting, we keep saying this, they were not expecting to see Jesus again. So when this person shows up in their midst, they were not thinking, oh, this might be Jesus. So their skepticism may well be the thing that is keeping them from seeing who Jesus really was. Again, no expectancy, no hope. They were not expecting this. So they were kept from recognizing him. He, Jesus, asked them, what are you discussing together as you walk along? They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days? And then I think we go on. Yeah, what things, he asked. About Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. See, they still don't really know or understand who Jesus was. They describe him as a prophet, not as the Messiah, the saving one, the one who could come back to life. They weren't thinking that. They were thinking, well, he was just a teacher or a prophet because he's been taken away from them. And then look what they say. But we had hoped, past tense, we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. He was the one who was going to rescue us. They had hoped. Earlier on, just a moment ago, I read, they were downcast. Their hope had gone. They were in despair. But even though they don't know it at this point, even in the midst of their hopelessness and their disappointment and their despair, Jesus is with them. Jesus is walking with them. Jesus is prepared to meet them in their hopelessness, their unbelief, and their despair, and walk alongside them in their disappointment. Now, I want you to hold that thought. There are three thoughts I want you to hold as we go through this morning. This is number one. that Jesus was with them in their disappointment. Hold that thought. Right, we read on. And what is more, they say, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they'd seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus. They are amazed. Another translation of this word says confused. And I really like that. They just can't get their heads around all of this, right? They're amazed. They're confused. They're on their way outside of Jerusalem. Jesus has been crucified. They don't really understand what's going on. And then to add to all of that, their fear and their confusion and their hopelessness, some people start telling them, well, actually, we went to the tomb and there was no body there. And then somebody else says, but we saw Jesus. And then somebody else, we saw some angels. And now they're really mixed up in their heads. And they would have been thinking, not we wouldn't think this now, 2,000 years on. But they were thinking, but it's the women who are telling us, and we're not supposed to believe them. Their testimony does not carry as much weight as a man's testimony would have done 2,000 years ago. So they're now completely confused. And there is no Jesus. And we may be thinking, come on. It's obvious, surely. All of this is adding up to a conclusion. Why are you not coming to that conclusion? Why are you walking away from Jerusalem? Why are you walking away from the scene of all the action? Are you idiots or what? Why are you not seeing this? But this shows to us the extent of just how difficult it was for them to believe this, just how skeptical they were, just how hopeless they were. They are skeptical about this idea that someone who was dead could come back to life. That there could be life where there was no life. And I wonder if sometimes we might feel that way too. How does this really happen? Can this really be? Can you really expect me to believe in a miracle like this, that somebody who was dead has come back to life? Maybe you're in a place this morning where you're exploring faith and you're not quite sure what you believe. And you think to yourself, I'd really like to be a Christian, but I just can't rationalize this miracle stuff. I can't get my head around it. Maybe you're asking the question this morning, do I really have to believe in miracles to be a Christian? And maybe if you are a Christian, you're thinking to yourself, I'm in, but I still, sometimes this miracle stuff just stretches my thinking a bit. Or maybe you know people who say to you, I can't believe you're a Christian because you have to believe in all that miracle stuff. There are quite a lot of people in our day, particularly in academic circles, who are writing and talking a lot these days about how great Christianity is. Even Richard Dawkins, did you see that this week? Even Richard Dawkins on LBC over the Easter weekend said he considers himself to be a cultural Christian. This is the Richard Dawkins who slams religion, who slams the Christian faith, who's a passionate atheist, considers himself to be a cultural Christian because he loves the things that Christianity has brought to the world. But then he says, but resurrection from the dead, what nonsense that is, in the same interview. Extraordinary. People sometimes struggle, and sometimes it may be us or our friends, people that we know. How do I have to believe in miracles to be a Christian? If I could just not do that part, I think I'm in. Here's the thing. You already believe in miracles. Those friends that you're thinking about right now already believe in miracles because even the most devout atheist believes in a miracle. Even the most devout atheist believes in life coming from no life. Life came from a place where there was no life. Because to know that we exist and to know that there was once nothing, and then at some point, maybe millions of years ago, there was this moment that sparked the development of this universe of planets, and that the conditions on one of those planets was just so perfect and so finely tuned that life could come into existence and evolve into what we have now. To believe that kind of life can come from where there was no life is to believe in a miracle. Because it is way more unlikely, with all of those fine-tuning constants that just have to be so perfect for life to exist, that when you try to express it as a mathematical probability, there are so many zeros on the end of it that we don't even have a way of describing that number, To believe that is to believe in a miracle, and to believe that is to believe that not just one life came from no life, but billions of lives came from a place where there was no life. That, my friends, is a miracle. Thank you. And to call yourself an atheist is to believe in that miracle. The issue is not whether or not you believe in miracles. It's which miracle are you going to believe in? One which ultimately fails to answer the questions of why it all happened and whether there's something behind it all and what the meaning and the purpose and the value is of human life. Because to believe in that atheistic miracle of how life came to be is to believe in something that has no meaning or purpose behind it. Or are you going to believe in a miracle that explains everything? This one miracle of a resurrected Jesus explains everything. It explains the why and the who and the purpose and the value to human existence. Which miracle are you going to believe? That's the question. And by the way, if you want to explore the logical and rational evidence for a resurrected Jesus, really want to encourage you to get on our Next Steps app. Because we've been recording a series of videos that are being released one a week over the weeks of this series, where we examine five pieces of evidence for the resurrected Jesus. It started this week with the empty tomb, and it's going to go on over the next few weeks. So if you want to explore the evidence of why it's logical and reasonable to believe in a resurrected Jesus, I really encourage you to get hold of our Next Steps app and to follow along with that over the next few weeks. Right, that is a hobby horse, well and truly ridden, I think you'll agree. And so shall we move back to the rest of the story? Here he goes. He, that is Jesus, said to them, "How foolish you are." Like we were saying just a minute ago, are you idiots or what? Jesus. How foolish you are. And how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Are you idiots or what? He didn't say that. That's my paraphrase. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. What Jesus does here is he shows them the bigger story. The bigger story of God and his place and his part in the bigger story. You see, Jesus is a part of the bigger story of God, a story that makes sense of life, a story that makes sense of human history, a story in which the resurrection is the central event, but which fits within this broader narrative of who God is and how he's been at work in the world. He speaks to them and tells them the story of God, this bigger story. That's hold that thought number two, okay? We read on, verse 28 and onwards. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he were going farther, but they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening, the day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. They urged him to stay with them. And as we shall see in just a moment, it's after they hang out with him that things really began to change. They wanted to hang out with Jesus, even though they didn't yet recognize him. And it's after they started hanging out with Jesus that things began to change. That is hold that thought number three, and it's to do with hanging out with Jesus. Right, let's go on and see how things change then. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. It was as Jesus did something with them that they were very familiar with, which they had seen him do before, which was eat together and share bread together. As he did that thing that was familiar to them, that he had done many times before with them, that they recognized him. And if you were here last week, you'll remember we talked about Mary. And Mary, similarly, did not recognize Jesus until he did something she was really familiar with, which was call her by name. And then she recognized him. There's parallels here, do you see? They didn't recognize him until he did something that they were familiar with. This familiar activity of breaking bread, of sharing food together, now laced with new purpose, new poignancy, new power, and new potential. And it changed everything for them. Look what happens when they experienced Jesus and they recognize him. They asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11, that's the closest of Jesus' friends, and those with them assembled together and saying, it is true, the Lord has risen and he has appeared to Simon. They believed it now. And do you see what they did? They rushed straight back to Jerusalem, the place they were leaving from at the beginning of the story. The whole thing's turned around. And now they go back to the place. They're not afraid anymore. They're not disappointed anymore. Their despair has turned to hope and to joy. And they have opened up their hearts. And now they're opening up their lives to following Jesus and to tell the stories of what he's done. Complete and utter turnaround. In this, the second of the resurrection appearances of Jesus, we see how Jesus meets people and builds hope. And it's a different kind of hope than any of those three we were talking about at the beginning. It's a living hope. It's not a resilient hope or a realistic hope or a vague hope or an optimistic hope or a wishful thinking kind of hope. It's a living hope. A living hope, and I'm calling it that because it brings meaning and purpose and the promise that there is a bigger story that this is all a part of, that we can be a part of. That living hope enables them to feel fully alive, and it can do this for us too. How does Jesus build living hope in us? If you want that kind of living hope that can make you feel fully alive, how does Jesus do that? Well, number one, and these are the three thoughts we've been holding on to, right? Well done if you've done that, by the way. Here are the three thoughts you've been holding on to. Number one, Jesus meets us in our disappointment. Jesus is available to walk with us in our fear, our despair, our hopelessness, and our disappointment. He does it for them, and he can do it for us too. And the way we invite Jesus to walk with us in our disappointment is not to hide it from him, but instead to turn it over to him, to talk to him about it. We might not always get the answer we crave, but we get someone in Jesus who will walk along with us. Number two, recognize that there is a bigger story, that God can speak to us in this bigger story, that we and everything around us and all of history are part of this bigger story. This bigger story that goes on beyond us into the future, that's existed before we even existed, and in the future promises us the hope of a resurrection that we will experience too, beyond this life, with Jesus. I haven't got time to go into all of that, but again, on our app, I keep talking about our app, but on our app, there is a podcast that Becky and I recorded some time ago about heaven, and it's all about this future hope. Again, just encourage you to go on and connect and engage with that if you want to know how this future hope thing plays out when it comes to heaven. But also, we need to engage with that bigger story. We need to reflect on it. And again, we just want to help with that. You know, one of the things we often say around here is, we just want to help. We want to help. We want to equip you with all that you need. And this app is a great way to do that. This app is a great way to read and engage with the bigger story of God, because every day there's a suggested Bible reading as part of that app where you can read and engage with the bigger story and then dialogue with other people about it so we can do it together in community. It's how we want to help. And number three, we hang out with Jesus. Because, you know, it's as we hang out with Jesus that we get to connect with him and see him. And again, reading the stories of his life and the words that he said are a way for us to just hang out with Jesus and see what he thinks about stuff. It's as we listen to him and as we hang out with him that a living hope is built within us that gives us a future hope too. Now imagine for a moment how much richer your life would be if instead of being weighed down by past disappointments, being weighed down by hopelessness, you were filled with a new sense of hope. And what if that hope could be for you like an anchor? I'm so excited we found an anchor this week. I've been thinking about this all week, and this is like a word I've had in my mind all week, and I'm so pleased to Rob Harmon, who lent me an anchor. But what if that hope were like an anchor that you could tether your life to, that would provide a foundation for a firm and steady and consistent thing to tether your life to build your life upon, that would help you and keep you holding fast and holding firm, even when storms of life came and the tides of life flowed in and out, or the waves of life were towering above you. Wouldn't you want that? Wouldn't you want that kind of hope? Wouldn't you want that kind of anchor? You know, in the New Testament, as well as the stories of Jesus' life, there are letters that were written to various people in various places. And in one of those letters, a letter to a bunch of people called the Hebrews, it says this: "Therefore, we who have fled to him for refuge can have great confidence as we hold to the hope that lies before us. This hope is a strong and trustworthy anchor for our souls." Don't you want that? A strong and trustworthy anchor for your soul. Wouldn't you want that kind of hope in your life? What do you need to be fully alive? What do I need to be fully alive? We need to be transformed by love and surprised by hope. A living hope that gives us a future hope, that gives us an anchor to build our lives on. The resurrected Jesus met those people right where they were and gave them an anchor of hope for their lives. And he wants to do exactly the same for us too. Let's pray, shall we? Lord God, I just want to pray for any of us here today who this really resonates with, who this picture of an anchor really speaks powerfully to us. Because if we were honest, we'd be saying, you know, I've been drifting, I haven't been tethered to anything, and that drifting has led me to feel hopeless, disappointed, and maybe even in despair sometimes. If that's you, this is so for you today. I hope if that's you, you hear God speaking to you today, that this is not a coincidence, that this is the image we've got for today to hold on to. Lord God, I pray, build in our lives an anchor of hope. Remind us again of this central event in human history, Jesus risen from the dead, that gave hope to his followers 2,000 years ago and is still giving hope to millions of people today. Thank you that it's entirely reasonable that we should believe in someone resurrected from the dead. Thank you that belief brings life and meaning and purpose and explains everything. And thank you that it brings a hope like an anchor for our very souls. Move through us now this morning, I pray, as we continue to sing and to worship you. Move through us, I pray, and build that kind of living hope in our lives, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.